Today's reading is from Matthew. Then the disciples of John came to him saying, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" And Jesus said to them, "The wedding guests cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, can they? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old cloak, for the patch pulls away from the cloak, and a worse tear is made. Neither is new wine put into old wineskins. Otherwise, the skins burst, and the wine is spilled, and the skins are destroyed. But new wine is put into fresh wineskins, and so both are preserved." The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
If we were living in England, there's a special tradition that we would likely observe on this day at the stroke of midnight. When the clock first strikes 12, and in many parts of England, they go to the back doors of their home and they open up the door. And maybe they stay at that door for a few counts. 12, 11, 10, 9. And you intentionally let go of the year that it was. But at some point you turn and make your way through the house as the bells keep going. 8, 7, 6, 5. So that by the time you reach the final tolling of midnight, you open up the front door to let the new year in. Isn't that a cool tradition? I think it's there's a part of me, though, I found myself thinking, man, it'd be great to be a cat burglar in England. You know exactly when you could just easily slip into someone's house. But I love that symbolism of opening up the back door to say goodbye to the year that has been. You know, as Matt was talking about, so we've all had those years before when we need to say goodbye to what has been. Whether we face disappointment or loss, or maybe things are a crisis in health, things just haven't gone the way we expected the year to go, and we need to kind of open that back door and air out and let it go. Matt and I were talking about this right before Christmas. I was sharing with him where Jamal and I thought we were going to go with this message, and he shared with me a text or a series of posts from Facebook. One person said resolutely, "I refuse to enter into 2018 with 2017 problems." And the next person beneath them cynically said, "Shoot, I'm going into 2018 with 2012 problems." We all have this tendency to hold on to the past. We have this complicated relationship. All of us have had those years that we want to let go of. And yet, without meaning to, we carry many of the same problems, many of the same hurts, resentments, and habits into the new year with us. And we find ourselves kind of stuck in this cycle of repeating what was old. We have a complicated relationship with the past. Sometimes the past is painful, but at least it's familiar. At least it's known. At least we know how this works. Embracing what is new can be scary. And this is no less true in our day than it was in Jesus' day. Embracing the new is challenging, and we see that in today's story. The disciples of John the Baptist come to Jesus and they ask a very simple question. We fast and the Pharisees fast. Why aren't you and your disciples fasting? And Jesus replies to them and he gives them kind of two separate answers. The first answer he gives them takes their question kind of at the literal level. Why aren't you fasting? And he explains, well, almost by analogy. He says, because the bridegroom and the friends of the groom, they don't feast while the wedding is on. He's referring to the culture of the day and the way they celebrated weddings. In our culture, the bride and the groom, they go off for a week for a honeymoon, but not so in Jesus' day. Instead, for a week, the new couple stayed at home and kept an open house. And in that week, it was kind of like they were just treated as kings and queens. In fact, they would even be addressed as kings and queens during that week by whoever came to their home to share in the festivities. And they would have kept their groomsmen, their maids of honor, to be present with them to celebrate all week long. And Jesus is basically saying that that is this period that we are in. This is the honeymoon period. This is the celebration. It's a wedding feast. It's a time for celebration, not for fasting. And he seems to indicate that there will be a time for fasting on the horizon, but it's not right now. Now, that kind of addresses the question right at the literal level. Why aren't you fasting? Well, because I'm here, and I'm the bridegroom. I'm the center of this party, and we're going to keep this party going. But then he takes it, Jesus doesn't stop there. He addresses the question behind the question, because there is a question behind the question. When they ask, why aren't your disciples fasting, why do they care? I mean, what's the big deal? Are they just mad that someone else is not having to skip out on food when they're doing the same? Why do they care that Jesus' disciples aren't fasting? Well, fasting was one of the, what some scholars say, is one of the three pillars of religious observance, Torah observance in those days. That at the center of Torah observance in first century Judaism, there was fasting, there was giving, and there was prayer. And your observance of those three was very visible. In fact, that's to some degree why Jesus addressed all three of those in his Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 6, about how those three should be practiced in secret and not in public. Because that was the common practice among Pharisees, among disciples, was to make their almsgiving, to make their fasting, to make their prayer very public for everyone to see them keeping the Torah. It wasn't just about keeping the Torah. It was about keeping to a way of life that was very important to the people of first century Israel. Because, see, they were struggling with the new. They just recently, in the last century, been made captives of Rome. And Rome brought with them a new way of life. Literature, laws, taxes, wealth, ways of building, infrastructure, new gods, new freedom on what you could eat. I mean, it was an all-out assault on their way of life. And of course, the Romans wanted nothing more than for the Israelites to assimilate, for them to take on Roman ways of living, to enjoy being part of the empire, not someone standing against it, but someone who would support it and be part of it. That was what the Romans wanted. And so for first century Jews, fasting was, it was one of their lines of resistance. It's one of the trenches they dug. It was a cultural battle. And they were seeing Jesus and his disciples, they weren't joining in the fight in the same way. They weren't fasting along with everyone else. They were giving up something essential. Why aren't you fasting? And so we see what Jesus addresses in the second part is this desire, this clinging to old ways. Because the Jews, it wasn't just that they were clinging to the way things are. They were clinging to the way things used to be as a way of making sense of who they were. And this is what Jesus addresses. He says, no one takes a new patch of cloth and puts it on an old garment, because that new patch wouldn't have shrunk. And so the first time it gets wet, when it begins to shrink, it's going to pull and tear the old garment. It'll rip it to shreds, and the whole thing will be worthless. He says, in the same way, when you have new wine, you don't pour it into an old wineskin. They didn't pour into bottles, they poured into skins. And new wine was still fermenting. It still would have been giving off gases. And if you put it in an old wineskin, all those gases would cause the skin to expand, and an old wineskin had lost its elasticity. It would just simply burst under the pressure of those gases, whereas a new wineskin still had some stretch in it, and the gases wouldn't cause it to explode. You can put old wine in an old wineskin any day, but new wine has to go in a fresh wineskin. Now, these are examples that everyone of Jesus' day would have understood, but what is he really saying? I think he's addressing the problem of when the old ways don't work anymore. What do you do when it's not working anymore? Do you just patch it up and keep on going? Or is something new required? I had an old 2000, when Jamal and I went to Haiti, I had an old Honda Accord. It was a 1994 Accord. This car I absolutely loved. It had well over 200,000 miles on it, you know? And it kind of reached that age where every year something was going to break down. It was going to be the axle, or it was going to be this or that. And every time it broke, I had to do this calculus in my head. Is it worth to keep patching up this old car, or should I just ditch it and get something new? And in my mind, I was always thinking, well, yes, this is $2,000, but that's still cheaper than a new car payment. You know what I mean? Like, you do this calculus in your head. But they eventually reached the point where pouring more and more money into an old car didn't make sense. It was sheer folly. And this is the calculus we sometimes have to think about in our world today. How long do we keep patching and propping up something that doesn't work? Or is something new required? I think this is perhaps, for me, the most sympathetic way that I can look at many of the debates taking place in Washington today. When it comes to our healthcare system, when it comes to our tax system, what's needed? Do we need just patches to keep the old thing running okay? Or does it all need to be torn down and start over brand new? For me, that's the most sympathetic way I can understand the debates that are taking place today. It's a real question. What is needed? But let me push it even further, because I think Jesus isn't just talking about the problem of is patching necessary, will patching work? The real crux, I think, for Jesus, the stories he tells, is that the patches actually make it worse. I mean, the new patch of cloth actually tears the old up. The new wine poured into the old wineskin bursts the old wineskin. See, the truth is that the new threatens the old. The old will always be threatened by the new. Have you ever been in any kind of organization where someone says, well, we've never done it that way, or I don't want to, or that's not the way we usually do things, then you know exactly how this feels. Because anytime something new comes along, the old is instantly threatened. And anytime the new comes along, there is fear of real loss. I think it's Donald Cooper, who's most best known for his quote, people don't resist change, they resist loss. People don't resist technology. What they resist is the loss that technology brings. When you see a family all sitting together and they're all looking at their phones, no one's making eye contact, there's a loss there. When you look at our political divide, over the new year, I've been reading some articles, and some of the senators who are now leaving office, they say, you know, when I first came in, there was more of an overlap between Democrat and Republican. Yes, we each had our own camps, but there was some middle ground. There were some Democrats who were further right than some Republicans, and vice versa. He says, but that's all gone. There's been a loss of civility and common discourse in our world. There's loss that's taking place, and we have to ask, is all change good? No. Change brings about loss. And I think that's what's really driving the disciples who are approaching Jesus. They're afraid that what he's teaching and what he's doing is going to result in the loss of something essential to them. And Jesus basically says, yeah, you're right. Because I'm not offering a patch. I'm not offering an old wineskin. The new wine that I want to offer you, it requires complete and total change. If you just try to take what I'm teaching and pour it into an old container, an old way of doing life, it's just going to rip apart. It's just going to burst. You got to do something new. And so as we look ahead at a new year, as we look at new life that Jesus wants to give us, I ask you the simple question. What old is incompatible with the new in your life? What are the things in your life that when you look ahead, if you're going to embrace new life in 2018, that you have to say, I can't carry that with me anymore. It's time to let go of that. I want to offer you three categories to think in about things that you need to perhaps let go of. The first, I want you to think about habits. Are there habits that need to be let go of as you go into 2018? We started off this year, 2017, here at St. Luke's with a series called Making Changes Stick. If you were here at the beginning of the year, we had lots of post-its everywhere, and we were talking about all the changes that we wanted to stick in our lives. We were asked to kind of visualize those things. It was kind of a way of saying, well, the resolutions we all make every year, how are we going to make those things stick? Most of my changes that I wanted to see happen revolved around my personal health. And it's funny, so I had success in some and not in others. I was successful in adding, I set the goal of running a half marathon. And I ran not just one, but two half marathons. And as a result of training for those, exercising daily, going for runs became part of my daily habit. So that's yay on the plus side. But the other part about losing weight somehow didn't happen. And it's because all the things that I wanted to do around my diet didn't change. I found it a lot easier to add something new than to let go of a destructive habit. And so, James and I have been talking about it, like, okay, 2018, no fast food restaurants. If there's a drive-through, we're not going through it. That's a small thing. That's so 2017. It's not going to be part of 2018. And that seems trivial, I know, but it's not. You may have something in your life. Maybe it's a pattern of spending, of living beyond your means that's driving you into debt, needs to stop. Maybe it's a pattern of speech, lying, gossiping, criticizing, that's destroying core relationships in your life, it needs to stop. Maybe it's something deeper, an addiction, an affair. Something at the core of you that's destructive and you know it. If you get still before God, you simply open yourself up and say, God, what in my life is incompatible with the new life you want to offer me? Where would you put the finger? Where would you say, that needs to change? You got to leave that behind. So that's the first thing that I think sometimes we have to leave behind is habits. A second thing I would think invite you to think about is hurts or resentments, particularly if you've suffered some kind of injury this year. And by injury, I don't necessarily mean a physical injury, but any kind of loss, a loss of a marriage, a loss of a job, a loss of a church. I know many people come to St. Luke's because they have been injured in their previous church home. Wherever you've suffered an injury, especially if there's a sense of injustice that you have been wronged, you've been hurt, we tend to want to hold on to those hurts. And I don't know why we hold on to the hurts. I think sometimes it's just our desire to see justice done. We tell ourselves that only if, you know, we see this person come to light, only if we see them suffer in the same way we've suffered, only then could we let go of this hurt. But the biblical notion of forgiveness, it's simply letting go of our need to have the other person suffer, of our need to exact justice, to release justice into God's hands. That's forgiveness. And that letting go is not easy, but it's what's required of us, because the truth is, as long as we carry that hurt, as long as we carry that resentment, we're not hurting the other person. We're only hurting ourselves because we're the ones who are carrying it. Jable would share with me a parable, a proverb that I'd never heard before. She said, the story goes of two Buddhist monks living in China or Tibet, somewhere in Asia, very traditional. And as they were going along on a journey, they came to a river that was overflowing its banks, was very difficult to cross. And as they were trying to figure out how to get across, there was a woman who asked for their help in crossing the river. Now, these were very traditional monks. They had taken a vow to never touch someone of the opposite sex, to never touch a woman. And yet, seeing her need and distress, the older monk said, I will carry you across. And so she got on his back, and he carried her across the river, and the younger monk followed along behind. Now, after he finished crossing the river, he set her down and the two continued on their way. Some 2 hours later, finally the younger monk had the courage to speak up and say, "Excuse me, I just have to ask, why did you touch that woman? We took a vow never to touch a woman. How could you break your vow like that?" The older monk, rather than answering the question, just simply turned and said, "Oh, my son, I set her down 2 hours ago, and here you've been carrying her all this time." Sometimes there comes a time and a place where we just have to let go and set down our burdens instead of carrying them forward. Lewis Meads, I love his words the best. He says, "To forgive someone is to open a door to set a prisoner free, and then to discover all along that it was you who was the prisoner, not the person that you are imprisoning." So what hurt might you need to let go of so that you can enter 2018 free in your spirit? And the last category I want to offer up is fears. Because I think fears are also a sort of a prison that hold us in place. When Jamel and I were dating and starting to get serious, I was getting to that point where I was looking at rings. During that time, I was working as a chaplain in a hospital, what we call a CPE residency. Like most residency programs, it's kind of a learning environment, and we were put into a group, five of us, that we would spend 10 to 15 hours a week together processing our experiences together, supporting each other, praying for each other. We got really tight with our residency group. And in our group, there were four of us who were all young, in our 20s, just starting out in ministry. And then there was one person who didn't quite fit the rest of us. Her name was Connie, and she wasn't in her 20s. She was in her late 50s. And she wasn't just starting out a career path in ministry. She was actually undergoing a change in career path. And because Connie, you know, was older than the rest of us, she naturally kind of took a mother hen, you know, approach to all of us. We were about the same age as her children were, maybe a little bit older. And so she kind of looked after us and cared for us and would bestow wisdom on us. And one particular day we were talking, and I was really struggling with fear around asking Jamelyn to marry me. I knew I loved her. I knew I wanted to spend my life with her, but I was still afraid. And I think anyone who says they're not afraid is just kidding themselves. Because that kind of commitment forever. And I was so afraid that how do you know if you're making the right choice? How do you know? And I remember it was in the context of talking about this, and it was just Connie and I in the office. And Connie just turned to me, she said, "Dave, what are you afraid of?" And I said, "I don't know. Divorce." And she said, "Dave, I've lived through your greatest fears. In fact, I'm still living through them right now. Everything that I was so afraid would happen to me has happened." She says, "This is the only wisdom I can tell you, is that I'm not dead. I'm still alive, and God is with me." And who would have thought those would be the words that would set me free? But it was. That's exactly what I needed to hear. And I think about them often as I'm with people who are facing their greatest fears. I just think, no, you're not dead, you're still alive, and God is still with you. And it wasn't so much that, you know, that I was free to marry Jamelyn because if it didn't take, it'd be okay. No, it was once fear was removed, then all I had to ask is, what does my heart truly want and desire, and seek the desires of my heart? What would happen in your life if fear were removed? If you knew that you couldn't fall beyond grace? When Jamelyn became the pastor of outreach ministries here, I wanted to encourage her to dream, and so I got her a paperweight for Christmas that year. And she still gives me a hard time about my extravagant giving. But the paperweight said this very simple question. I wanted her to put it on her desk and ask herself this every day. What would you attempt to do if you knew you couldn't fail? If fear weren't part of the equation, what would you attempt to do? And it's true that all of us are going to fail sometimes. Maybe a different way of phrasing it would be, what failure would you risk if you knew you couldn't fall beyond grace? As you look ahead to 2017 or 2018, What are the things that need to die? Are there habits, hurts, or fears that you have to let go of? Because Jesus says, it's a feast. When you're in his presence, it's time for celebration. And at the wedding feast, there's no place for those fears, for those hurts, for those habits, because he's making all things new. And that includes us by his grace.